It's the early 1990s. Bodybuilder Daniel Lugo is managing the Sun Gym in Miami Lakes. But he wanted more than the modest life he was living.
He wanted, to be a millionaire, to, live a fast life. He really worked hard to come up by any means necessary.
Soon, Lugo decided that the best way to get what he wanted was to take it from someone else. He was going to con a wealthy gym client of his money. Lugo recruited three of his bodybuilder friends to help him with his plan.
And they decide that it's all golden ticket to the easy money. Let's take this guy for everything he has.
But soon, their greed turned to bloodlust. And the group of bodybuilders known as the Sun Gym Gang would go on to commit some of the most gruesome crimes Miami had ever seen.
They went from low-rent scammers to, vicious, murdering psychopaths.
Hi, I'm Joey Dowd.
And I'm Kareem Tapsch.
Beaches, nightlife, and tropical weather may be what folks imagine when they think Florida. But as Miami natives, we like to say that South Florida is a sunny place for shady people.
Each week, we'll bring you a new episode of a true crime case committed right under the Florida sun. From the outrageous to the utterly bizarre. Think you've heard it all? Think again. This is Paradise Lost, Crime in Miami.
It's the summer of 1994 in the suburb of Miami Lakes. It's a middle-class neighborhood. Ranch-style homes, small businesses, and cow pastures. In the middle of it all is the Sun Gym, a gathering place for serious bodybuilders.
And it was basically one of those really old-school 1980s gym where it's all, free weights and dumbbells. No machines.
That's Francisco Alvarado, an investigative journalist who reported on the Sun Gym Gang.
Remember the classic documentary Pumping Iron with Arnold Schwarzenegger, where he's working out with all these bodybuilders at a place called Muscle Beach in California? Well, the Sun Gym was Miami's version of that. But being Miami, it had a darker cast of characters.
And it attracted an array of characters from Miami's underworld, crooked cops, drug dealers, hustlers, you name it.
According to a three-part series in the Miami New Times, which is where a lot of the information in this story comes from, the Sun Gym was known to be made up of, quote, cops and bad guys, end quote.
A Miami police officer who worked out there said he could hit his monthly quota of felony arrests in one night if he just ran background checks on everyone at the gym. The Sun Gym was owned by a guy named John Messi, but it was managed by Daniel Lugo. Which, by the way, was played by Mark Wahlberg in the 2013 film Pain and Gain. That's right. This story made it all the way to the big screen as a Hollywood blockbuster, directed by Michael Bay and also starring Dwayne The Rock Johnson, Anthony Mackie, and Tony Shalhoub.
Lugo's got an interesting backstory. At this point, he's 30 and had moved down to Miami from New York about 4 years earlier after finishing a stint in prison for fraud.
He had just, finished a 15-month federal prison stint for defrauding people out of $71,000. He claimed he could get them loans from a Hong Kong bank, and the bank never existed, and he just basically ran off with the cash.
So Lugo ends up in Miami, and he gets a job as a personal trainer at the Sun Gym. But he wants to be more than just a trainer.
He had high aspirations for himself. He wanted, to be a millionaire, to live a fast life. And he didn't see himself going pretty much, anywhere just as a manager of a gym, or as a, personal trainer.
Now, through George Delgado, a Sun Gym member, Lugo meets a man named Mark Schiller, who was a business associate of Delgado.
Mark Schiller was a successful accountant, and he also dabbled in some other businesses. He owned a Schlotzky's Deli near the Miami airport and a nutrition supplements company. He owned more than one house and had offshore bank accounts all filled with money.
He owned a house in this very luxurious neighborhood of Miami Beach called The Gorse. And he's buying a condominium building that was under development in the city of Miami Beach. And, he owned at least $300,000 in, house furnishings.
He was worth a couple of million dollars. Lugo gets to know Schiller and learns of his wealth. He has a target. Next, he hatches a plan.
And so Lugo comes up with a story saying that Schiller stole $100,000 from him. Probably none of this was true, but this was enough of a story to get a few other gym members feel like Lugo had been wronged and they needed to get Schiller to make this right.
And then they decide that, well, get your money back and let's take this guy for everything he has. You know, let's get him to sign over everything. We're going to take all his money. And then that's when they start plotting of like their scheme to kidnap the guy.
So Lugo comes up with a plan where he wants to kidnap and extort Mark Schiller and have him sign over everything that he's got. In addition to Delgado, they got some other gym members, including Adrian Dorble and Carl Weeks, to help with the plan.
First step of this plan, abduct Schiller. Now, these guys are what you might pejoratively describe as a bunch of meatheads. They aren't the smartest criminal masterminds. They go to a spy shop, buy some surveillance gear and tasers, and do some recon on Schiller.
One of their original plans to kidnap Schiller was to dress as ninjas during Halloween, knock on Schiller's door, and abduct him. But they didn't go through with that one. They did have an attempt where they dressed in black with camo makeup, crawled across Schiller's lawn, and waited for him to get to the morning paper. But a passing car spooked them.
It would take them six failed attempts before finally abducting Schiller on their seventh try on November 14th, 1994.
So after several attempts, including one attempt that they aborted, they went back to the deli, you know, around 4 p.m. in the afternoon. And at the time, I guess they had, you know, Schiller was waiting for somebody that wanted to, like, look at the deli for, you know, to possibly buy it from him. And when the buyer didn't show, he went back to his car, a Toyota 4Runner. And just as he was about to get in, three guys grabbed him and he got stunned with a taser. They just yanked him away and they finally pulled him in into the, you know, into their Astro van, and they put a gun to his head and they told him that, you know, keep his eyes shut or he was going to, you know, they were going to kill him. And they drove off to this warehouse.
They take him to a warehouse that Delgado owns in Hialeah, an area of Miami. And basically, they treat him like a prisoner. They tie him to a wall in the warehouse and gag and blindfold him. Then they start interrogating him.
Well, they started off by taunting him and hitting him and kicking him. Someone kept asking him, why do you have so much money when, you know, everybody else has no money?
Then they take it to another level and start torturing Schiller. They burned him with his own Sharper Image all-weather lighter.
They burned him, his arms and his chest with lighters. They pistol whipped him. They kept hitting him with the tasers for like 2 hours on end.
They played Russian roulette on him, where you put one bullet in the chamber of a revolver, spin it, and then pull the trigger, hoping it didn't stop on the loaded chamber.
Whether the gun was actually loaded or not, who knows? But regardless, it's pretty psychologically damaging to think you might die at any moment.
This goes on for a few days. To avert suspicion with why he suddenly disappeared, they have him make calls to his family and business associates.
They have him tell his wife to leave the country, go to Colombia where she's from, and don't tell anyone. And she does.
Telling his wife to get the kids out of the house, don't call anyone, not to call the police, and to go to Colombia. And his wife, believing that they were in danger, followed suit and left the country.
For his friends and business associates, they have him read a script with a wildly fabricated story. He says he's fallen in love with a young, hot Cuban woman named Lilian Torres, and she drove him, quote, loco. And he was going to convert his assets to cash and ride off into the sunset with her. This cover story both explain why he's disappeared and what's about to happen next.
So while Schiller is getting tortured, Lugo is having him sign documents. He's blindfolded with duct tape so tight that blood runs down his nose. He signs a variety of documents. Some give Lugo power of attorney, which he uses to sell Schiller's deli. Others are for transferring money out of Schiller's accounts to his own, basically stealing all of his money.
They were hoping that this would only take a couple of days. It would torture the hell out of this guy. Once they got his signature on everything, they would be able to get everything he owned.
It wasn't just the cash in Schiller's bank accounts they were after. He also had offshore accounts that took time to access. They also transferred his house, car, jewelry, everything.
And if you're thinking, wait a minute, don't these documents have to be notarized? They had that covered. SunGem owner John Messi was a notary and signed off on all the documents. Schiller also had a $2 million life insurance policy, which was then signed over to Lugo. Now, initially, they thought this would only take a couple of days, but converting all of Schiller's assets to cash took time. This went on for weeks.
That's weeks of torture, of sight deprivation, of constant fear for Mark Schiller.
But in the end, it all went through. They end up netting about $1.2 million in cash, real estate, cars, credit cards, and jewelry, and a $2 million life insurance policy.
And then finally on, you know, December 10th of 1994, when the last money transfer went through, they decided, you know, it was time to, you know, to get rid of Schiller.
But before we go further, I mean, do you have any just thoughts, like your own opinion of just like, it just seems like such a progression of like, you know, these kind of gym guys who ran scams to are like torturing and murder, like brutally trying to brutally murder this guy. Do you have any like thoughts of just like what would kind of compel them?
Well, my theory is, you know, how they went from lower end scammers to vicious murdering psychopaths is that they were just like desperate to come up. People that come to Miami, like they get caught up in the fast life real fast, just, you know, going to strip clubs, going to nightclubs, buying bottles, showing off in exotic cars, showing off jewelry. People, you know, get caught up in that lifestyle real quick.
So the plan they hatched to kill Schiller is literally right out of the classic Alfred Hitchcock film, North by Northwest. They're going to force him to drink a bunch of alcohol so he's blackout drunk, strap him to the driver's seat of a car, then crash the car and have him die in the crash. In their minds, this will look like a DUI, case closed, no investigation into them, and they ride off into the sunset with his millions.
As we saw how competent they were at kidnapping Schiller in the first place, this shockingly does not go to plan.
So on December 14th, they made Schiller, like, you know, take a bunch of sleeping pills, drink a lot of alcohol, and, you know, they just kept, you know, they just forced it down his throat.
They forced him to drink for three straight days. At 2:30 in the morning, Lugo drives Schiller's Toyota 4Runner with Schiller passed out in the passenger seat. Dorbel and Weeks follow in another car. They drive out to a remote area in Miami and strap Schiller behind the driver's seat of his Toyota 4Runner. Then they pull one of those movie stunts where Lugo slams on the accelerator from the passenger seat, aims the car to pole, and jumps out before it hits. The car does hit the pole, but it's a minor crash and doesn't kill Schiller.
Time for plan B. In this new plan, the car catches fire after the accident, killing Schiller. So they douse the car and Schiller in gasoline. For good measure, they also put a propane tank in the car. With the same Sharper Image all-weather lighter they had been torturing Schiller with, they light the car on fire. Mission accomplished. They pack it up and head out.
As they're about to drive away, they look back. And then they notice. Schiller's not dead. Despite being drunk, despite being on fire, Mark Schiller has enough sense to get out of the car and try to get away.
So they decided, well, we got to run him over. So they hit him, and, you know, they, you know, Schiller bounced off the hood, and then they were about to drive away, and then, you know, Lugo and Dorbel said, hey, no, you gotta run him over. You gotta run him over again. And they turned the car around again, and they ran him over again.
They're about to run him over once more, but a car was approaching, so they sped off. However, with Schiller basically poisoned with alcohol, set on fire, hit with a car twice, they were convinced he was definitely dead. They were wrong.
Miraculously, Schiller survived. He gets taken to a hospital. He tries to tell the nurse what happened, but they write him off as a drunk, just as Lugo thought they would. While in the hospital, Schiller gets connected with a private investigator named Ed Dubois. Dubois used to run security for the Miami Dolphins and now has his own investigation agency.
Dubois listens to Schiller's story, but doesn't take it very seriously. In his defense, Schiller was brought in as a DUI, so there was very little reason to believe him, especially with such a wild story.
But Dubois does tell him if what he says is true, then once the people who tried to kill him multiple times find out that he is still, in fact, alive, they're going to try to kill him again. So he needs to get out of there ASAP. And Dubois was right. Lugo and crew were scanning the newspapers, looking for a mention of a dead drunk driver, but found nothing.
They eventually track Schiller down to the hospital he's at. Their new plan is to go to the hospital and suffocate him with a pillow. But by the time they get there, Schiller is gone. He chartered a private medical transport to New York, where he stays with his sister. Eventually, he'll head to Colombia to be reunited with his family. But this isn't the end of Schiller. He's dead set on revenge, and he wants Lugo to know he's after him.
He lets these guys, Lugo, Thorvald, and their accomplices, know that he's still alive by having his brother call them and tell them, hey, you know, like, I'm coming for you, motherfuckers.
Despite Schiller getting away, Lugo and crew still see this as a wildly successful crime.
But it's only a matter of time before they want more. Soon, they'll set their sights on a new target to try to get even more millions.
It's January 1995. Daniel Lugo moves into Mark Schiller's home, which he now owns because he forced Schiller to sign it over.
It had a big swimming pool, a jacuzzi, an entertainment system with a 15-inch television. You got to remember, this is like the mid-1990s, so a 15-inch television was pretty big back then.
Francisco says 15-inch TV, but he meant 50-inch, which was quite luxurious for the 1990s. Despite Schiller surviving multiple attempts to kill him and escaping to Colombia, Lugo and crew thought they had pulled off a masterful con.
You know, they were living large. They had come up. They finally reached the mountaintop in Miami.
Meanwhile, in Colombia, Schiller is plotting his revenge. He writes up everything that happened, everything he can remember, and sends that to Dubois.
He also starts digging through the damage and piecing together what Lugo did. He starts seeing crazy credit card charges, $80,000 worth. He discovered his Schlotsky Deli franchise was dissolved. His house now belongs to a corporation registered in the Bahamas called D&J International. At this point, he doesn't know that this is a shell corporation created by Lugo. And he discovers that $1.26 million from his offshore accounts were all wiped clean.
So, Dubois has this whole write-up from Schiller and decides to confront Delgado. Dubois is trying to rattle his cage, see what he can get out of Delgado. He says he knows what he did. He tells him it would have been the perfect crime if he killed Schiller, but he didn't and he's going to go down. At first, Delgado denies having any idea of what he's talking about. But then, being the criminal mastermind he obviously was, he tells Dubois that he'll pay Schiller back $1 million if he signs a document agreeing to never speak of what happened.
Obviously, a huge confession to at first be like, I have no idea what you're talking about, to then go, I'll give you $1 million to never speak about the thing that I'm saying I didn't do. Dubois knows this is a ridiculous idea, but goes along to see how much more info he can get and if he can get enough evidence to go to the police. Dubois and Schiller consult an attorney who is also shocked Delgado would even ask for such a thing.
He says, quote, what kind of bozo says to his attorney that Schiller is accusing me of kidnapping him for a month, torturing him, and stealing all of his money and property? It's a lie, but I'm going to pay him the $1.26 million anyways, end quote. The attorney wasn't even sure Delgado could find an attorney crazy enough to draft this agreement / admission of guilt. But being Miami, they did find one.
Then that's a confession we can take straight to the cops. But none of this ever happened.
Despite finding an attorney, this agreement never went anywhere. Schiller felt this was a ploy by Delgado to buy some time, find him, and kill him.
Schiller does get a small victory. He challenges the deed transfer of his house and an investigation begins. Rather than fight it and risk getting busted, the gang decides to move out and abandon it. But not before totally wiping it clean.
So they took the 50-inch television, they took Persian rugs, they took sculptures, they took couches, they took silver, Waterford crystal, the washer, the dryer, the freezer. I mean, like, took out the jacuzzi. There was like nothing stopping them. Add insult to injury, they took Schiller's favorite snakeskin briefcase and a pair of $600 sunglasses. They even took his personal items, like family photo albums.
They took about $150,000 worth of items from the house. Also, taking his family photos feels like a personal FU to Schiller.
Now, even though the contract confession never went anywhere, it was enough to confirm Schiller's story, at least to Dubois. And Dubois felt they had enough evidence to go to the police. Now, this is kidnapping, extortion, attempted murder. They expected to be sent to an investigator. Instead, they were sent to the robbery division. Robberies are a dime a dozen in Miami. This was the police's way of saying, we don't believe any of your story. File a report, and we'll add it to the pile of all the other robberies. Before they were blown off and sent down to robbery, Dubois warned the investigators that what this gang did to Schiller, they'll probably do again. And the next victim might not be lucky enough to get away.
Dorable learned of a man named Frank Griga. Griga was a Hungarian immigrant who made millions through a phone sex empire.
These were the 1-800 and 1-900 numbers that you'd call to have phone sex. Options were limited in the pre-internet days. This was big business. The caller would spend up to $5 a minute to engage in sexually explicit chats with telephone actors and actresses. In the Hungarian community of Miami, Frank Griga was known as the Alexander Graham Bell of phone sex.
This made Griga a fortune. In 1994 alone, Griga's phone sex line brought in $3 million. He collected luxury automobiles. He had a $250,000 Lamborghini Diablo, which would be about $520,000 in today's money, and a Dodge Stealth, which he used to run errands. He had a mansion on the Intracoastal Waterway in Tony Golden Beach, a condo in the Bahamas, and a yacht called Foreplay.
As you can see, a lot of parallels to Schiller. Lots of money, lots of property. The Sunjim gang had found their next target.
The Sunjim gang had zoned in on their next target, Frank Griga, a Hungarian expat whose phone sex hotline empire had made him millions.
Lugo and Dorable hatch a plan. Because Griga doesn't have a connection to the Sunjim, they have to find a way to make an introduction.
So they pose a serious businessman who want to offer Griga an investment opportunity. If they would be able to get a meeting alone with him, they could kidnap him, take him back to the warehouse, and run the exact same torture and extortion scheme they did with Schiller.
They managed to get a first meeting with Griga through a mutual connection of Dorbal's.
They were looking like a couple of Wall Street traders. You know, they were dressed in like really fancy suits. And you talk about chutzpah, Dorbal like was even wearing Mark Schiller's presidential Rolex, so he could dress the part. And then, yeah, they sat down with Griga and Lugo made the pitch. He even had color brochures with pie charts and graphs showing how much growth potential this phone line business in India was going to have. And the only real competition was AT&T. And they needed serious investors who were willing to put in between $500,000 to $1 million to get in. Griga was like, sold. He's like, I'm probably even going to invest more than $1 million.
First meeting goes off great. They were even given a tour of Griga's house by his girlfriend, Christina Furton. Unbeknownst to her, she was basically giving them a free pass to scope out the place and plan their abduction.
So, Lugo and Dorable decide the next day is when they'll abduct Griga.
Unsurprisingly, the abduction doesn't happen the next day. But it does happen a few days later on May 24th, 1995. Lugo and Dorbal were going to meet Griga and Christina at a steakhouse, but when they arrived, the steakhouse was closed. So they decide to go to Dorbal's house down the street for drinks.
Lugo and Christina start watching television on a 50-inch TV. That would be the exact same 50-inch TV that they stole from Mark Schiller. Now, Dorble and Grigo walk into another room to talk business.
And then all of a sudden, there's a a huge argument breaks out from behind the door of this room, and then there's like all this commotion. So Lugo and Christina run into the room and see that Dorball and Griga are in a vicious fight. Blood is running down Griga's head, where he had been hit with a hard blunt object. There was blood splattered all over the computer screen, the sliding glass doors, there was blood on the walls. And then Dorball grabbed Griga, put him in a headlock, and proceeded to strangle him, like choking the guy. All in front of his girlfriend, who's screaming.
Presumably, while Dorball and Griga were chatting, Dorball hit him on the head, thinking it'd knock him out cartoon style. But it didn't, which led to this fight and all this blood.
With Christina screaming, Lugo put his hand over her mouth, handcuffs her, and ties her feet with tape. Then he tapes her eyes and mouth shut.
Then he injects her with Rompin, a horse tranquilizer. She's almost instantly knocked out. Then he gives Griga the same tranquilizer.
But of course, this being, Lugo and Dorball, so they don't really put much thought into how they're going to do things. They just know they're going to, go ahead and they just charge through, and when they do it, they don't put much thought into it.
But not being medical experts, or frankly, experts on anything, they give Griga way too much tranquilizer.
He was on his last breath. He was completely immobile. There was no way they were going to get him to be able to sign anything.
Despite Christina being much smaller than Griga, not only does the tranquilizer not kill her, but she wakes up. She freaks out, so they give her another dose to knock her out again. As for Griga, they'd given him way too much. He was dead.
And that's when, they realized that they had botched their next, golden ticket to easy money.
So now Lugo and Dorball have a dead Frank Griga and a passed out Christina Furton, whom they're most likely going to have to kill since she was a witness to everything. They call up Delgado. Remember, the plan was to take them to his warehouse to torture and get Griga to sign everything over. So Delgado is waiting for an update and they tell him to come over.
Then they bring a new character into the mix.
So that's when they bring in this guy named John Raimundo. One would think that the last thing you want to do is bring in another witness or another in your murder plot. But, Dorball and Lugo are obviously not the brightest criminals that ever walked the earth.
Raimundo is a member of the Sun Gym, a karate expert and a self-proclaimed expert in body disposal. Dorball told him he'd pay him $50,000 to get rid of two bodies.
Now, this next part, and for that matter, the rest of the story, are going to get extremely graphic. Raimundo shows up at Dorbo's townhouse. According to court documents, what Raimundo reportedly did next was pick Christina up by the ankles so she's hanging upside down. She starts moaning, so she's still alive. He then lowers her a bit, rests her head on the floor, and stomps on her face, yelling shut up. The stomp snaps her neck and kills her. He then drops her on the ground.
But Raimundo denies he ever did this.
So the interesting thing about Raimundo is that back in 2013, after the movie Pain and Gain, when this movie came out, I had done this, a series of stories about the Sun Gym Gang and rehashing, the whole history of the case and whatever. So after I wrote those stories, I got a call from John Raimundo, and he completely denies the entire version of him, picking her up by the ankles and, stepping on her head and telling her to shut up. He claims that that never happened. He does admit that he was there, and that he did, participate in getting rid of the bodies.
Raimundo told them he'd be back later to help dispose of the bodies, but he never returned.
With the clock ticking, they'd have to get rid of the bodies themselves.
So on May 26, 1995, Delgado goes to a U-Haul and rents a white Ford van. Lugo and Dorball go to a Home Depot in Miami Lakes. They buy cleaning buckets, They buy 10-gallon containers of repair tar. They buy fans, industrial-strength towels, 100-foot roll of hefty bags, propane gas tanks, face goggles, gardening gloves, fire extinguisher, and a chainsaw.
They hide Griega's body in Mark Schiller's stolen couch, and they put Christina's body in a U-Haul clothing box. They put them in the back of a van, and they drive to Delgado's warehouse.
They needed to dispose of the bodies. Now, again, another warning, this part is extremely graphic. They have their supplies they bought from Home Depot, including the chainsaw.
They lay the bodies out on garbage bags on the floor. They strip them of their clothes. They scrub the bodies with Windex to remove any fingerprints they might have left on them.
I really don't know if that was an effective way of removing your fingerprints, but that's what they did.
Next, they fire up the chainsaw. Or try to. It doesn't start. They realize they had forgotten to put oil in the chainsaw and had burned it out before they even got to use it.
So the chainsaw doesn't work. So you would think that we'll just throw this chainsaw away. But no. What does Lugo do? He goes back to Home Depot and demands a refund. Then, while he's still there, he gets a power cutter. They came with a one-year guarantee to handle all your cutting chores quickly and easily.
With the power cutter working, Dorval gets to work, dismembering Griega and Christina. He was left to do the work on his own. Lugo and Delgado didn't have the stomach for it. But eventually, the power cutter also stops working. As he's cutting off Christina's head, the blade gets stuck in her hair, jamming it.
He had the sense to not go back to Home Depot for a refund this time. Instead, he had Lugo come out to help him as he used a hatchet to finish the job. Then they put the bodies in barrels filled with a mixture of tar and acid.
First, they were putting like the legs, the torsos, into the drums when they had the the light bulb went off on their heads, and oh shit, their fingerprints, and their faces, and their teeth. So before they put the heads and the hands in the drums, they pulled out the teeth using pliers. And then they chopped off their noses, they hacked into their eyes. It's like one of the most gruesome acts of murder that you will ever, read about.
Dorval couldn't finish the job that night. He had to leave to go on a date. But eventually they moved the barrels with their bodies and Griega's Lamborghini to the Everglades. Except they kept their hands and feet separate and burned them in a propane fire in order to destroy them. Then they dumped them in a barrel in a different part of the swamp.
Frank Griega was a well-known member of the Hungarian community, so his disappearance didn't go unnoticed. As police were running through a list of suspects, some of these names sound familiar to Captain Al Harper. Harper had talked to Ed Dubois back when Schiller was trying to get police to investigate his abduction and attempted murder. Now, it sounded like there might be a connection between the two crimes.
Schiller flew back to Miami to help the police piece together what happened. He told them about his former business associate, George Delgado, whom he had been forced to grant power of attorney. He told them about Daniel Lugo, whose voice he recognized in the warehouse when he was kidnapped. He told them about the people who took control of his bank accounts and stood to benefit from his life insurance policy. Dorval, Lugo, and Lillian Torres, Lugo's ex-wife. He also told them about John Messi, the Sun Gym owner who notarized and helped facilitate the transfers.
But none of this info should have been new to the police. It's exactly what they told them 2 months earlier.
Dubois, told the cop, told this detective, hey, I told you guys all this information, and you blew me off. And here we are, and it ended up costing two people their lives.
Now the police were moving fast. They issued search warrants for Lugo, Delgado, Dorval, and Messi.
4 days after Griega and Christina disappeared, Griega's Lamborghini was found in the Everglades. The barrels with their bodies were eventually found by a ditch. Their bodies were only able to be identified by a single tooth from Griega and the serial number from Christina's breast implants.
Once they got Delgado under interrogation, he sang like a bird. He said that he had hired Lugo to collect the money Schiller owed him, but that Lugo got carried away. And then Delgado's lawyer showed up and told him not to talk anymore. Dorval, he went to police headquarters, of his own free will. While he was being taken down to the police station, the cops, they searched that house for evidence. They took furniture, they took jewelry, they took computer equipment, software. everything that had, basically everything that he had taken from Schiller's house, the cops, you know, took as evidence.
Oh.
They also found the photo album in Dorball's apartment.
Schiller's photo album?
Yeah, Schiller's photo album in the apartment. And while he was being questioned by the cops, Dorball said that he was involved in the kidnapping Schiller. But then, you know, that was the only thing he would admit to. He didn't say anything. The last thing he said is that I'll never see daylight again.
At this point, Lugo had already fled to the Bahamas, but was arrested 5 days later in Nassau by a multi-agency task force and sent back to Miami.
In total, 11 people were arrested and charged in connection with this plot.
The trial ended up being the longest, most expensive criminal trial in Miami-Dade history. It featured more than 1,200 pieces of physical evidence and 98 witnesses, including Mark Schiller, who had been flown up numerous times to help from Colombia. His courtroom testimony was crucial in the case convicting the Sun Gym Gang. Since Delgado flipped first, he got 15 years in prison.
So Daniel Lugo was convicted of racketeering, first-degree murder, kidnapping, extortion, arson, burglary, robbery, grand theft, and forgery in 1998. I believe he was sentenced to life in prison. And he's been filing appeals ever since. So Dorval was convicted as directly for the murders of Frank Griga and Christina. So he was sentenced to death, but then the death sentence was overturned in 2017. He was also convicted of, conspiracy to commit racketeering, kidnapping, attempted extortion, grand theft auto, kidnapping, armed robbery, and extortion and arson.
Now, there's one final twist to the story. During the trial, Schiller had been flying back and forth to Miami from Colombia to help convict the Sun Gym Gang and get his revenge. After they were convicted, there was one final hearing for the death penalty. He didn't have to come back to Miami for it, but he wanted to speak at the sentencing.
As Schiller's leaving the courthouse, he gets surrounded by cops and arrested. Turns out, this entire time, he had been wanted for a $14 million Medicare fraud. The feds knew this the whole time, but wanted to use him to help prosecute the Sun Gym Gang first. Despite losing everything, despite the torture, they still arrested him.
He now faced up to 25 years in prison, which was 10 more than Delgado had received for his kidnapping and the murder of Griga and Christina. So in 1999, Schiller pleads guilty to one count of false Medicare billing. During the sentencing, Judge Ferrer, who presided over the Sun Gym Gang case, took the rare step to speak on Schiller's defense.
He said, quote, "There's something intangible about this case that makes me feel like what he went through should be given some credit, because I don't think it could have been worse if he was a prisoner of war," end quote. Schiller got 46 months and paid $137,000 in restitution, which was the most lenient sentence possible under federal guidelines.
He actually had to spend time in prison. He got 2001.
Schiller later wrote a book about his experience, also called Pain and Gain, The Untold True Story.
When you reflect back on the story with the twist of, of Schiller also having to go to prison for committing fraud, it kind of just speaks to the whole ethos of Miami. Clubbing up by any means necessary is how I like to phrase it. And, people just get into dirt. And it's kind of like a cautionary tale of what happens when you want to come up by any means necessary. So it's a twisted version of the American dream.
So, I actually grew up one town over from Miami Lakes in Carroll City, and coincidentally, my older brother Jimmy worked out at the Sun Gym.
Did you know any of these guys?
Nah, it was actually a few years after all of this went down, but his former roommate was a competitive bodybuilder, and he did know a few of these characters, and has said they're about as bright and upstanding as they sound. Everyone's always has a few degrees of separation in Miami from some real crazy shit.
Thank you for listening to Paradise Lost, Crime in Miami, where each new episode will bring you a true crime story right from the South Florida headlines.
Paradise Lost, Crime in Miami is a production of Sonoro and Trojan Horse in partnership with iHeart's My Cultura Network. Hosted and produced by Kareem Tapsch, Joey Dowd, and Christian Hatar. Edited by Angelina Mosher Salazar. Fact-checking by Evelyn Uribe and Sara Mota. Engineering by Mane Parra, Daniel Padilla, and Fernando Galaviz. Executive produced by Jasmine Romero and Joshua Weinstein for Sonoro, Kareem Tapsch and Alex Fumero for Trojan Horse, and Giselle Bansis and Conal Byrne for iHeart. Listen to Paradise Lost, Crime in Miami on the iHeart Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.